Mary Pickford may have been called America's sweetheart, but she was actually the biggest movie star in the world. In the course of a career that spanned three decades, she was creatively involved as an actress, writer, and producer in over 200 films, including Sparrows, Little Lord Fauntleroy, The Poor Little Rich Girl, Pollyanna and My Best Girl. She founded United Artists with Charlie Chaplin, D.W. Griffith, and Douglas Fairbanks in 1919, and was an especially astute businesswoman. So the mystery is, why has she been largely forgotten nowadays? Crystal Schmidt has edited a gorgeous book for the University Press of Kentucky called Mary Pickford, Queen of the Movies, as an effort to remedy that neglect. It's also in honor of the 120th anniversary of Miss Pickford's birth. Crystal joins us now with Ben Modell, who will be accompanying a number of screenings of Pickford movies throughout the New York area in the coming days. Welcome to our show. Ben,
yeah, thanks
welcome
for having
back.
Me.
Thank
and,
you.
And before we get into Mary Pickford, Ben, that was music from one of her films, Sparrows.
By me, yeah.
Now, is that that's what I was going to ask. Was there a score written for that film, or is it just something you improvised?
I generally improvise. I'm trying to remember if that one had
no, it didn't. Not that we know of.
Yeah, most of the films of Mary Pickford's did not have a complete organic score written out. Ironically, most of Douglas Fairbanks' films did have a complete organic scores that were sent out.
Well, they were married. Did they not discuss this over the dinner table?
I don't know.
It's really interesting. I've never been able to figure out why this was. His productions are much more larger scale, and hers tend to be a little bit more intimate, and that may be the reason why, or maybe someday we'll unearth them somewhere. But I know that Sparrows and The Black Pirate opened together, and I'm sure The Black Pirate had an elaborate score,
it
so
does.
I can't imagine that Sparrows didn't have one, at least for that opening.
Yeah.
But
it's
a mystery.
Yeah, there were scores that were compiled from orchestral music that every movie theater had in their library. But it was the exception to have a complete score sent out with the film.
Crystal, your book subtitle is Queen of the Movies, which Pickford was first called 100 years ago. Was she comfortable with that?
No, it's actually a funny story. She was horrified because at that time the movies really were considered a low form of entertainment. I like to say it was kind of like today's reality television, and she didn't want to be associated with something called the movies. So she would have preferred to have been called the queen of the motion picture or the photo play. That's a little bit of her snobbery showing.
But they still would have been the same films.
Oh, most certainly.
It's just like saying film instead of movie.
Yes. I think she was really all about the uplift of movies. And so for her, if it had a kind of a nicer name, movies seemed just a little bit too slang for her, I think.
Well, hadn't she wanted a stage career initially?
She did want a stage career initially. She saw herself as being a great Broadway star. But the truth is she fell in love with the movies. And when she went back to the stage in 1913, after already attaining the title of Queen of the Movies, she realized that the stage was no longer for her. And she went back and then had the phenomenal career.
Was Mary Pickford her real name?
No, her real name was Gladys Smith. Mary Pickford.
Gladys Smith?
Gladys Smith, which wasn't going to work in movies. And she got that name. Pickford was a family name, and her middle name was Marie, so it became Mary. And she was given that by Broadway producer David Belasco. They worked it out. What should your name be? And so that was it.
How young was she when she started working? She became the family breadwinner from the start. The family was really poor?
The family was very poor. She was born in 1892. Her father died when she was five, and it was very traumatic. Her mother was having trouble keeping the family together, and she decided that she would become the father of the family. Those are her words.
But that must have been an incredible burden on a child.
Yeah, it was an incredible burden, and I think it really impacted everything she did afterwards. You know, that desire to earn a huge living for security and take care of her family forever, which she did do.
When did she come in contact with D.W. Griffith? When did she start working for him?
In the spring of 1909. She had been working for Belasco, and the season ended, as it usually does, at the end of the spring, early summer. She needed a job, and her mother said, I want you to go down to the Biograph Studios in New York, and I want you to get this job. And she did not want to do it because, again, being in the movies was a very, very far step down from being on Broadway with Belasco. But she did. She was a good daughter, and she did it. She went down, and she got herself a good salary, and she said, if I'm going to make movies, I'm going to make money.
And that's before Hollywood took over.
Way before Hollywood took over, yeah.
Ben, what are her movies like to accompany on piano? You've seen quite a few silent films over the course of your career.
Yeah.
How does she compare with other stars of her time?
Well, I think the big difference, whether I'm playing piano or a theater organ, is that usually when you accompany a film where a woman is the lead, it's almost always a love story. And Mary Pickford's films, while she does play an adult in a number of them, she's usually a younger woman or a teenager. And one of the nice things about that is it gives her license to have some strength of character. There are things that she wants that she's going after and not just a guy. So you're not just playing love themes and waltzes and that sort of thing. So there's more. The other thing is that she made so many films and in so many different styles. She may have been, a very young woman in most of her films, but there's films like A Heart of the Hills. It's a sort of a rural backwoods story, and Dorothy Vernon of Haddon Hall, which we're going to do at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington on Wednesday, is this big, almost Douglas Fairbanks type thing. And the film we're doing this afternoon is another type. So it's sort of like the way Frank Lesser worked in all these different genres, but was still great in all of them.
And these Pickford films are being shown all over the metropolitan area?
We're going to be showing, actually after this show, we're going to be at the New York Public Library showing one of her World War I films, and then we're going to be in Huntington for Dorothy Vernon of Haddon Hall, and then on Sunday, May 5th, we're going to be showing Sparrows at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria.
We'll also be showing Sparrows at Wesleyan in Connecticut on Thursday.
Yes, as well.
All because we're celebrating her 120th anniversary?
Well, actually, it's 121 now because in April she did clock over. Uh-huh. But it was a way, look, I always say this. I can write beautiful essays about Mary Pickford, and so can many of my writers. But the best person to speak for Mary Pickford is Mary Pickford, and she does that through her work.
Well, a lot of actors who worked in silent films would be accused today of overacting, but not Pickford. How did she learn to act for the camera and underplay? She looks so much more modern than somebody, the other people in the films that she's appearing in.
It's really amazing. Some of it could have come from Belasco, who was very much into realism in the theater. But we really don't know for sure because she never commented on that. And of course, working in the movies is much different than working on the stage. But, she watched those films, and I think she was very keen on how things would appear. She wanted to give the best performance, and I think she just had this natural ability. She's got a lot of charisma, and she's very subtle, and she stands out from the pack.
But that means that you have to adjust your piano playing, doesn't it?
Well, in the same way you do for someone like a similar star, Lillian Gish, where there's so much you can tell what they're thinking just by looking at them, and so
For a silent film,
which is what makes her a natural in so many ways that you can, your eyes just go to her. Even in some of the earliest films from 1909, with that maybe the blocking and the staging isn't that great, but you always know where to look because your eyes just go to Mary.
Yeah, that at the beginning she didn't even get credit, did she? The films at the beginning didn't say starring Mary Pickford.
Correct. Biograph was really the last of the studios to give credit to actors starting in 1913, and she had long gone by then. Some actors are getting their names out in 1909, but Biograph was not one of those. And a lot of actors didn't mind this because they didn't want to be associated with the movies. But she left Biograph to go work for the Independent Moving Picture Company so she could get her name out there. And at that point, she was known. But I'll tell you, she was known before that. I mean, they were calling her the Biograph Girl, the girl with the curls, Little Mary. A lot of her characters' names were Mary, and she was such a short stature. Those film fans right away focused in on her, and you can see why when you see the films, because she's just charming.
And she was the first person, let alone the first woman, to understand what starring and making films was really all about. Can you tell us about how adept she was at driving hard bargains?
Yeah, well, it started when she went to go see Griffith, and she said, I'm a Belasco actress, and if I'm going to work for you, you're going to pay me $40 a week.
Which was a lot of money.
Was a lot of money. They were paying the actors, for the most part,
$5
a day.
That's what they're paying me now here at WNYC.
Yes. I understand. And so, she was always looking for more money because she really felt she had taken a step down. So if she wasn't going to do high-quality work, at least she was going to get paid. And that continued throughout her career. I mean, her salary negotiations and what she was being paid was always being discussed because very quickly she is a fan favorite within the first few months of working, and she always was able to parlay that into making more money.
So she was always making more than other people?
Pretty much, yes. And by the time we get to 1916, when she has this revolutionary contract and she's making $10,000 a week, which is an extraordinary sum of money since the average American's income for the year was only $750, you know, she knew what she was worth and she demanded it. And you have to give her a lot of credit for that. She knew that she was worth something.
Well, how involved was she in the other aspects, finding projects, hiring screenwriters, cameramen, scriptwriters? Did that have to wait until they created United Artists?
No. It's very funny because even before 1916, getting her own production company, her producer, Adolf Zucker, said she was into everything. She's in the cutting room. She's talking to the director. She's concerned with costumes and lighting.
And she had conflicts with Zucker.
She had conflicts with a lot of people because she wanted what she wanted. And so this is what made her push for to be her own producer. But, you know, I always say this, she was a visionary. She saw film as an art form and an industry, and she wanted it to be more than what it was. So she wanted quality productions, good directors and things like that. And she fought for it, and she knew to get it, she would have to be running the show.
Well, we tend to think of her as a child star, but some of her best work was in rather adult films. Test of the Storm Country, My Best Girl.
This is fiction. It's really hard to battle. I hear it all the time. Oh, she didn't play an adult till she was in Dorothy Vernon. It's just bunk. The woman made 205 films. She played a woman in many films. Her average characters are teenagers, usually 16 to 18 range. But she did play older. But she did play children, but not in as many films as people think. And it's very hard to battle that. It's just misconception.
And these films often come across as feminist and also very concerned with the plight of the poor at a time when that was not the common approach of films?
Well, the working class and the immigrants were making up those early film audiences, and it's one of the reasons why I think that they were drawn to Pickford, because there's something really working class about her persona. It's what drew me into her. And her films really are about the underdog achieving, which was really her life story. And I think that resonated with a lot of people who went to the movies.
And then they were remade again and again with people like Janet Gaynor, then Shirley Temple.
Yeah, and I think that didn't help things, because I think then people thought what Mary Pickford was doing was what Shirley Temple was doing, but that's obviously not the case. A grown woman could not do that, and they were different films, very different films.
Did marrying Douglas Fairbanks add to her luster? They must have been one of the first celebrity super couples.
They were the first celebrity super couple. It added to both their lusters, which is really saying something, because really the big three performers in the world in movies were Pickford and Fairbanks and Chaplin, and they even became more famous, which seems really hard to believe.
Was it a good marriage?
It was a good marriage. You know, they had had an affair for many years before they got married, and, you know, it really was, they were the love of each other's lives. Unfortunately, it didn't last, didn't work out for many reasons. But many people say that they didn't survive their divorce. She just lived a lot longer.
My guests are Crystal Schmidt, the editor of a new, I guess we call it a coffee table book. Gorgeous book with
illustrated
lots of wonderful
book of essays.
Mary Pickford, Queen of the Movies. It's from the University Press of Kentucky. And Ben Modell, who has established himself as our premier accompanist of silent films.
Well, my parents think so, yeah.
Do you do anything else, Ben?
No, this is what I do full time. I tell people this is my real job.
Mm-hmm. Well, but there is still resistance, especially generational resistance, to seeing films. To seeing silent films. Has that been changing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened is that whereas in the 60s and 70s you used to be able to flip through the four or five channels and discover silent film here in New York, Channel 13 public television, or in the afternoon on the independent stations, that's been replaced by YouTube, as iffy as some of the quality of what gets uploaded is. You can accidentally discover silent films. And there are a lot of younger people making silent movies. There's an iPhone app called Vintagio that I've been sort of helping a little bit with. You can make a silent movie, and people are making them and uploading them. So it's actually gotten a little easier to find them, and there are young people coming out to these things.
Well, how many of the films, of Pickford's films, survive? You said there were 200.
Oh, this is a subject I know a lot about. You know, like I said, she made 205 films, and the majority of those survive because of her. I think there are 10 features that are lost and 25 shorts that are lost.
Considering how many other silents are lost, that's incredible.
It's extraordinary. I mean, she made 108 films for the Biograph Company, and every single one of those films survive. So,
Ben, you have a DVD called Accidentally Preserved.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, Accidentally Preserved is a term I've coined for films or classic or silent films that only exist because there were copies made in 16mm safety film for home use or rental use in the 30s and 40s. And there are a number of films that I've turned up over the years on eBay or whatever, where there's a couple that I have the only existing print, and some of them are just rare. So I've done a Kickstarter and scored them. They'll be out on a DVD.
In some cases, we find them in other countries. A silent film with Czech titles, things like that. One intriguing film she was in is A Kiss for Mary Pickford, a silent comedy from Russia.
Yeah, yeah. She was in Russia with Douglas Fairbanks in 1926, and there was a Russian comedian who asked her if she would, you know, she was going to visit the studio, if she would be in a scene with him, and basically he made a movie completely around that, and she was a good sport, and she said yes.
What led her to form United Artists with Charlie Chaplin, D.W. Griffith, and her husband?
Well, this is an interesting story. She had left Famous Players in 1918 to go work for a company called First National, and not too long after she got there, she heard rumors that First National was going to merge with Paramount, and she'd be back under basically Famous Players and Paramount's thumb, and she didn't like that idea. So they decided to start their own distribution company, and this is a way for them to really get around the burgeoning studio system.
Is it a surprise that so many of her films survived? Because she originally intended to burn them, didn't she?
Yeah, she said that, but I never believed that story. I think she said it for attention mostly. She is responsible for most of her films surviving. Most of the surviving Pickford films are in the Mary Pickford collection at the Library of Congress. She let some other archives copy them as well. We have as much as we have today because of her.
How long did she appear in films?
From 1909 to 1933.
Because Gish appeared in films a lot longer. Why?
If you think of a major silent film actor from that period, she's the first. There's nobody. There's no Chaplin. There's no Keaton. There's no Gish Bowe. She's there first. Gish comes to work for Griffith.
No, I meant later. I meant Gish continued working in films, television.
I see. She
throughout
did.
Her life.
She came back. You know, the issue with Mary is she was very rich and she didn't have to work. And Lillian did have to work and wanted to work.
It is rumored that she was the model for the actress in Sunset Boulevard.
Well, I think the story is they wanted her originally for the role of it probably wouldn't have been Norma Desmond, but that's just bunk. I mean, you know, even she said at the time when the film came out, that's not me.
Weren't her last years rather sad?
You know, she decided in 1965 she was going to retire from the public eye. I don't think it was maybe the life choice I would make, but, you know, I try not to judge. She lived a long life. She took a lot of blows. And she did an awful lot for a lot of people. And if she wanted to spend her last years that way, you know, Godspeed.
So I ask you about some of the movies you'll be showing. How many ultimately during this Festival of Mary Pickford Films?
I've had about six different programs. In New York, we're going to look today at Johanna and Liszt, which is a film, a lighthearted film she made during World War I, which will be a lot of fun. And then we're going to look, as Ben mentioned, we're going to see Dorothy Vernon of Haddon Hall, which was this very elaborate costume picture, which is more along the lines of what you would have seen from Douglas Fairbanks. And then we're going to see Sparrows, which is a film that was heavily influenced by German Expressionist cinema. So that was what we'll show on Sunday.
And we opened with Ben playing music from Sparrows, or
right.
Your music from Sparrows.
Yes, sure, yeah.
And I thank you both so much for being on our show. Ben Modell, who will be accompanying all of these screenings.
Except for the one on Sunday at the Museum of the Moving Image, and that'll be Donald Sosin.
Crystal Schmidt is the editor of Mary Pickford, Queen of the Movies, published by University Press of Kentucky. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.